Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. I'm Andrew McDermott. If you're a fan of Dr. Stephen Meyer's work, you'll be pleased to know that both Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell are now available in audiobook versions. To whet your appetite, we've arranged with HarperOne to share an extended sample of each book. On today's episode, we continue with the second half of Chapter 1 of Darwin's Doubt, narrated by Derek Shetterly.
A Solution Unseen. Of course, Darwin was well aware of these problems. As he noted in The Origin, the abrupt manner in which whole groups of species suddenly appear in certain formations has been urged by several paleontologists, for instance by Agassiz, Pictet, and Sedgwick, as a fatal objection to the belief in the transmutation of species. If numerous species, belonging to the same genera or families, have really started into life all at once, the fact would be fatal to the theory of descent with slow modification through natural selection. Darwin, however, proposed a possible solution. He suggested that the fossil record may be significantly incomplete. Either the ancestral forms of the Cambrian animals were not fossilized, or they hadn't been found yet. I look at the natural geological record as a history of the world imperfectly kept and written in a changing dialect, Darwin wrote. Of this history, we possess the last volume alone, relating only to two or three countries. Of this volume, only here and there a short chapter has been preserved, and of each page, only here and there a few lines. On this view, the difficulties above discussed are greatly diminished or even disappear. Darwin himself was less than satisfied with this explanation. Agassiz, for his part, would have none of it. Both with Darwin and his followers, a great part of the argument is purely negative, he wrote. They thus throw off the responsibility of proof. However broken the geological record may be, there is a complete sequence in many parts of it from which the character of the succession may be ascertained. On what basis did he make this claim? Since the most exquisitely delicate structures, as well as embryonic phases of growth of the most perishable nature, have been preserved from very early deposits, we have no right to infer the disappearance of types because their absence disproves some favorite, that is, Darwinian, theory. Though Darwin himself was less than enthusiastic about his response to Agassiz's objection, it seemed adequate to satisfy the needs of the moment. The overwhelming preponderance of evidence that Darwin had marshaled seemed to support his theory. In any case, many leading naturalists, Joseph Hooker, Thomas Huxley, Ernst Haeckel, and Asa Gray, all younger than Agassiz, quickly aligned themselves with his evolutionary line of thinking. True, some scientists, notably the Scottish engineering professor Fleming Jenkin and, later, the English geneticist William Bateson, expressed persistent doubts about the efficacy of natural selection. But despite the views of some weighty scientific critics, Darwin's revolutionary theory won increasingly wide support and soon defined the terms of the debate about the history of life. Those who rejected it wholesale, as Agassiz did, consigned themselves to increasing irrelevance. Agassiz under the microscope. So did Agassiz identify a genuine problem for Darwin's theory, a mystery at least, waiting to be solved? If so, whatever became of this problem? And if not, how could such a brilliant and knowledgeable scientist, someone so steeped in the evidence, fall so far outside the mainstream of scientific opinion? Historians of science in the post-Darwinian era have typically attempted to answer this later question by portraying Agassiz as a brilliant and respected scientist who nevertheless was too ossified to catch the new wave, a figure past his prime and mired in philosophical prejudice. Biographer Edward Lurie describes the Harvard naturalist as a giant of the 19th century, a person deeply involved in his surroundings, a man who understood the possibilities of life with an uncommon awareness. Similarly, historian Mabel Robinson says that she long awaited a biography of Agassiz that would recreate this man of genius and his headlong splendid race through life. He was, she said, a man to remember because genius is rare, an immortal Pied Piper. These scholars are merely echoing what Agassiz's contemporaries, even Darwin himself, said. What a set of men you have at Harvard, Darwin told the American poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Both our universities put together cannot furnish the like. Why, there is Agassiz. He counts for three. Even so, many historians argue that Agassiz was too infected by German idealism to properly assess the factual basis of Darwin's case. According to idealist philosophers of biology, living forms exemplified transcendent ideas, and in their organization provided evidence of purposive design in nature. Comments historian A. Hunter Dupree, Agassiz's idealism was of course the basis of his concepts of species and their distribution, of his insistence that a divine or intellectual cause must stand behind the origin of each type. The ship of science was transitioning from idealism to modern empiricism. Agassiz had fallen overboard, since he had imbibed too deeply an outmoded idealism from his teacher, the French anatomist Georges Cuvier, and from philosophers like Friedrich Schelling, who ran wild in trying to put all nature into a unified and absolute system of ideas. Agassiz wasn't merely wrong, Dupree explains, but an annoying obscurantist, actively fighting against the extension of empiricism into natural history. Edward Lurie offers a similar, if somewhat more nuanced assessment. Although quite capable of making the most admirable scientific discoveries reflecting complete devotion to scientific method, Agassiz would then interpret the data through the medium of what seemed to be the most absurd metaphysics. The very man who made the most careful, exact, and precise descriptions of the natural world would, in his generalizations from those observations, indulge in flights of idealistic fancy. In short, Lurie thought that Agassiz's cosmic philosophy shaped his entire reaction to the evolution idea. As science advanced to the late 19th century, it increasingly excluded appeals to divine action or divine ideas as a way of explaining phenomena in the natural world. This practice came to be codified in a principle known as methodological naturalism. According to this principle, scientists should accept as a working assumption that all features of the natural world can be explained by material causes without recourse to purposive intelligence, mind, or conscious agency. Proponents of methodological naturalism argue that science has been so successful precisely because it has assiduously avoided invoking creative intelligence and, instead, searched out strictly material causes for previously mysterious features of the natural world. In the 1840s, the French philosopher Auguste Comte argued that science progresses through three distinct phases. In its theological phase, it invokes the mysterious action of the gods to explain natural phenomena, whether thunderbolts or the spread of disease. In a second, more advanced metaphysical stage, scientific explanations refer to abstract concepts like Plato's forms or Aristotle's final causes. Comte taught that science only reaches maturity when it casts aside such abstractions and explains natural phenomena by reference to natural laws or strictly material causes or processes. Only in this third and final stage, he argued, can science achieve positive knowledge. During the late 19th century, scientists increasingly embraced this positivistic vision. Agassiz, by insisting that the Cambrian fossils pointed to acts of mind and an intervention of an intellectual power, stood firmly against this new vision. For many, his reference to the work of a transcendent mind merely demonstrated that he was unable to abandon an outmoded idealistic approach. The train of scientific progress had left Agassiz behind. An old fossil recovered. Though clearly Agassiz did reject the principle of methodological naturalism, as it is now named, there are problems with portraying him as a fossil of another age. First, Agassiz was unsurpassed in his commitment to the empirical method. It is Agassiz about whom the story is told of the professor instructing one of his students to observe a fish for 3 arduous days, a story iconic enough that it is reprinted in freshman composition textbooks. In the story, the student, Samuel Scudder, pulls out his hair trying to see anything new about the slimy creature, wondering why Professor Agassiz is torturing him with this hideous fish. But in the end, Scudder breaks through to new levels of observational depth and precision. Mabel Robinson notes that if such teaching methods seem less revolutionary to contemporary readers than they did to Scudder, that's because Agassiz trained an army of able young naturalists who took his method to other universities, and they in turn passed them on to their students, themselves future professors. William James, the founder of American Pragmatism, extolled Agassiz's commitment to empirical rigor in a letter he wrote to his father while on an expedition with Agassiz in 1865 to South America. In the letter, the young man commented that he felt a greater feeling of weight and solidity about the presence of this great background of special facts than about the mind of any other man I know. A storehouse of precise data made possible by a rapidity of observation and a capacity to recognize them again and remember everything about them. James would eventually enter the field of psychology, but he took with him the empirical approach to problem-solving that Agassiz had modeled so impressively. As Lurie concedes, Agassiz's stature among American scientists grew out of his unrivaled knowledge of geology, paleontology, ichthyology, comparative anatomy, and taxonomy. So passionate was Agassiz for the particulars of the natural world that he began organizing a system of information sharing among naturalists, sailors, and missionaries around the world. He collected more than 435 barrels of specimens, among them an extremely rare group of fossil plants. In a single year, Agassiz amassed more than 91,000 specimens and identified close to 11,000 new species, making Harvard's Natural History Museum preeminent among such museums in the world. He also appears to have gone to great lengths, literally and figuratively, to assess on the origin of species empirically, going so far as to make a research voyage retracing Darwin's trip to the Galapagos Islands. As he explained to German zoologist Karl Gegenbauer, he wanted to study the Darwin theory free from all external influences and former prejudices. The idea that religious or philosophical prejudice compromised Agassiz's scientific judgment raises other questions. As historian Neil Gillespie explains, Agassiz was second to no man in his opposition to sectarian religious interference with science. Moreover, Agassiz showed himself perfectly willing to accept natural mechanisms, where before supernatural intervention had been the preferred explanation. Since he regarded material forces and the laws of nature that described them as the products of an underlying design plan, he saw any creative work they did as deriving ultimately from a creator. For instance, he assumed this was the case with the development of embryos. He attributed their natural evolution from zygote to adult as a natural phenomenon and considered this no threat to his belief in a creator. He also readily accepted the notion of a naturally evolving solar system. He thought a skillful cosmic architect could work through secondary natural causes every bit as effectively as through direct acts of agency. The marginalia in his copy of On the Origin of Species suggest that he had this same attitude concerning biological evolution. "What is the great difference," he wrote, "between supposing that God makes variable species or that he makes laws by which species vary?" A third problem with the official portrait of Darwin's chief rival concerns Lurie's suggestion that Agassiz was a master of particulars, but not of generalizing from those particulars. The historical record suggests otherwise. For example, Agassiz was the man who ably generalized from a wide array of particular clues in his work on the Ice Age, winning over the geological establishment by demonstrating how a range of facts were best explained by the action of retreating glaciers. Here, a direct comparison between Darwin and Agassiz is possible. Each searched for an explanation of a curious geological phenomenon in the Scottish Highlands, the parallel roads of Glenroy. Glenroy is the valley of the River Roy, and, although it's a place of breathtaking beauty, what visitors found most intriguing about it over the years were its three parallel roads that wind along the canyon wall on either side of the river. See Figure 1.7 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Scottish legend held that they were hunting paths built for use by early Scottish kings, or perhaps even the mythical warrior Fingal. Scientists later argued that the roads were natural rather than artificial. Darwin and Agassiz were both convinced that natural processes were the cause, but they nevertheless arrived at different explanations. What was the end of the matter? In his autobiography, Darwin explained, "Having been deeply impressed with what I had seen of the elevation of land in South America, I attributed the parallel lines to the action of the sea, but I had to give up this view when Agassiz propounded his glacier lake theory." Subsequent investigations in the late 19th and early 20th centuries confirmed that Agassiz's interpretation was the correct one. Agassiz, then, was far more than just a walking encyclopedia or an insatiable gatherer of fossils who couldn't see the proverbial forest for the trees. Those who insist otherwise can point to but one example to support their position, namely his rejection of Darwin's theory. but they cannot use that example to establish his general inability to interpret evidence and then turn around and use that supposed inability to explain his failure to accept Darwin's theory. That is to argue in a circle. There is a far more obvious solution to the historical puzzle posed by the great Agassiz objection to Darwin's theory. The fossils of the Cambrian strata do, in fact, arise abruptly in the geological world, in clear defiance of what Darwin's theory would lead us to expect. In short, a genuine mystery is at hand. Two final considerations lend support to this view. First, as already noted, Darwin himself accepted the validity of Agassiz's objection. As he acknowledged elsewhere in The Origin, to the question why we do not find rich fossiliferous deposits belonging to these assumed earliest periods prior to the Cambrian system, I can give no satisfactory answer. The case at present must remain inexplicable and may truly be urged as a valid argument against the views here entertained. Second, Darwin's attempt to account for the absence of the expected fossil ancestors of the Cambrian forms failed to address the full strength and subtlety of Agassiz's objection. As Agassiz explained, the problem with Darwin's theory was not just the general incompleteness of the fossil record, or even a pervasive absence of ancestral forms of life in the fossil record. Rather, the problem, according to Agassiz, was the selective incompleteness of the fossil record. Why, he asked, does the fossil record always happen to be incomplete at the nodes connecting major branches of Darwin's tree of life, but rarely, in the parlance of modern paleontology, at the terminal branches, representing the major already known groups of organisms? These terminal branches were well represented, see Figure 1.8 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, often stretching over many generations and millions of years, while the internal branches at the connecting nodes on Darwin's tree of life were nearly always, and selectively, absent. As Agassiz explained, Darwin's theory rests partly upon the assumption that, in the succession of ages, just those transition types have dropped out from the geological record, which would have proved the Darwinian conclusions had these types been preserved. To Agassiz, it sounded like a just-so story, one that explains away the absence of evidence rather than genuinely explaining the evidence we have. Was there any easy answer to Agassiz's argument? If so, beyond his stated willingness to wait for future fossil discoveries, Darwin didn't offer one. An enduring mystery. In the years immediately following the publication of On the Origin of Species, many of Agassiz's concerns were temporarily swept aside as public and scientific fascination with Darwin's ideas grew. Even so, a persistent mystery lay at the feet of biologists, one that subsequent generations of scientists would revisit and repeatedly seek to resolve. As Darwin noted, in his time, the fossils of the Cambrian were relatively few, and the period of the explosion only vaguely understood. But perhaps future scientists would come to his rescue with fresh discoveries. The story of the successive attempts to solve the Cambrian mystery stretches from Darwin's time to the present, and from the Swansea Valley in southern Wales to remote fossil sites in southern China. In the next chapter, the work of detection moves from the late 19th century to the early 20th, from the British Isles to British Columbia, and to a fossil site above the Kicking Horse River so astonishing that, even today, paleontologists and some of the most skeptical and hardened of scientific rationalists speak its name with childlike reverence.
You've just enjoyed Chapter 1 of Darwin's Doubt, the audiobook version, now available at Amazon, Audible, and all good online and offline book retailers. Pick up a copy today and enjoy them again or for the first time. Drop by the book's website, darwinsdoubt.com, for ongoing coverage of the latest attempts to solve the Cambrian explosion, a gallery of beautiful fossil images, dozens of YouTube videos featuring Stephen Meyer, and more. That's www.darwinsdoubt.com. And look for other episodes of the podcast, where we'll highlight the audiobook version of Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. In the meantime, I'm glad you joined me today. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.